This week on the Coin Week podcast, we're going to talk about the Spirit Bank of Chicago and its enigmatic founder, Seth Payne. The Spirit Bank of Chicago was founded in 1852 when free banking rules allowed for an explosion in that industry. Payne's bank was based on his deeply felt spiritual beliefs, and it wasn't long before it garnered the attention of foes that wished to do it in. It's a fascinating story of humanism, persecution, and resilience, and you'll learn all about it next when author Nancy Shum joins us on the Coin Week podcast. The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. To learn about this quarter's grading specials, be sure to visit their website at www.pcgs.com. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for joining me on the Coin Week podcast.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's interesting, as a collector and as someone who writes about various aspects of the numismatic hobby, I sometimes stumble upon story ideas by complete chance. Today's episode is one of those occasions. I was reading through a nearly 50-year-old copy of a long-defunct coin collector magazine called Numismatic Scrapbook when I came across a very interesting, though brief, story about a 19th-century banker named Seth Payne. What little that was detailed in the piece was fascinating. Fascinating enough that I not only took some notes about it, but I searched far and wide on the internet to see what else might have been posted about him, his bank, and his banknotes in the time since. There were scraps of contemporary news accounts here and there. I discovered that in Lake Zurich, a town Payne founded, there was still an elementary school named after him. And then I came to find out that you had just recently written a comprehensive biography. And I just wanted to have you on to see if you could answer some of my questions and to help me tell our audience the unbelievable story of one of the most unique figures in the history of American banking.
I appreciate that. I agree with you wholeheartedly. He was definitely a unique character.
So let's start by talking a little bit about who Seth Payne was.
So Seth Payne was a man who was born in Vermont. He traveled when he was 17. He lost his father when he was young, and he traveled to Chicago in 1834. It was just starting out to really be a community of a lot of kind of Yankee migration. And so he started there, and then he eventually fell in with a guy who taught him a lot about the world and idealism, and he'd already had a pretty strong foundation in the Congregational Church back east and in a family that didn't like hypocrisy in religion. So he was already setting that stage. And so he kind of wanted to set up his own little utopian community out in the village of Lake Zurich, which was a suburb of Chicago and still is. And so he went through this growth period because he was very young when he traveled to Chicago at only 17, but he started building this utopian community and he started evolving. He happened to have a golden touch when it came to business. He was a merchant and sold dry goods and, you know, sugar and butter and things like that in Chicago, and he made a lot of money. And he started buying property out in the suburbs of Chicago. Eventually, he owned as much as 2,000 acres at one point. And everything he did in his life, he wanted to improve humanity. That was really his ultimate mission. And so when he fell into the abolitionist movement, he became very involved in the Underground Railroad. He ended up building a stable of humanity in Lake Zurich, which was pretty revolutionary for the time, where he would house travelers coming through who needed care or needed a space to live or somebody who wanted to start a business in town. So everything he did was really based on humanity. And as he grew and evolved, he fell into banking as well. He was an early investor in the Chicago Marine and Fire Insurance Company, and that was kind of the foundation of a lot of early banks, was the fire insurance company money, where people would hold their money temporarily in these insurance companies, and they'd make a little money on the side of it when people paid back the loans. He was also involved in the Bank of LaSalle, which was a western suburb of Chicago, for many years. And then in 1851, the Illinois State Legislature passed a free banking law. And at that time, the banks could secure, or someone could secure, a general incorporation charter to start their own bank. And if they were backed by railroads or industry or real estate by this time. So earlier banks had been established through legislative charter, and they could really only be established if you had political connections. And they issued those early bank notes being backed by gold and silver, and they were called specie at that time. So by 1851, all of a sudden, everybody could open a bank if they wanted to and if they had some backing. And so banking capital in the country quadrupled in the 1850s, and particularly in Chicago. And banks charged a lot of interest. They charged 10 to 15% interest on loans. So Seth came in, and he said he thought that was unfair because he thought it excluded regular people, people who were hardworking and common. He was very big into supporting the mechanics and the young industrialists who had ideas about mechanizing products for normal people to use on farms in particular. So he thought, I can do a better job, and I'm going to start this bank as a way to help the common man. And we're only going to charge 6% interest, and I'm going to back it with cash. So, and my own investments and those of my close friends. And we're going to start a little at a time, and we're going to build this great bank that's going to be really wonderful for humanity. He also, in a kind of revolutionary move, would loan money to women and children and Negroes first. That was, and then fourth would be spiritual-minded men. So he, and he'd even provide an extra discount if, you know, you were really a great person.
And reading through a few of the period newspapers, which gave, let's just say, a perspective into the business practices of Seth Payne's bank, the Spirit Bank of Chicago, and let's just say he had a very unusual and strict policy regarding who the bank would lend money to. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read some of the guidelines so our audience can get a sense of just how unorthodox this bank was. So according to their prospectus, they wrote, "We loan to no one to pay debts. We loan to no one to aid in the murder of anything which has life. We loan to no man to speculate in the necessities of life. We loan nothing on real estate, believing that it cannot be bought or sold. Possession with use is its only title. We loan nothing to aid in the manufacture or sale of liquor or tobacco. We loan nothing to gamblers or money lenders. Our basis for making loans is the established character of the borrower. He must be temperate, honest, and religious, with mind sufficiently developed to understand business." You know, never mind that many of these activities are at their core directly related to business. So the Spirit Bank was cutting out quite a few people who traditionally would use the banks.
It sure is. And this is at the same time that he became a spiritualist. And spiritualism itself was very controversial for a few reasons. Number one, it was new to the country. It had started in England among the upper class. It was based on the foundation of Christianity, but it was governed by the idea that you could communicate with the dead and that they would help kind of guide you through life. So it wasn't, it was kind of considered a threat to all the other wealthy capitalists who were really entrenched in their churches in particular. So because they felt it was starting to take money away from their churches, and people were really falling into the spiritual movement, and they were getting caught up in guidance through to reach spirits through mediums, and so it was somewhat controversial. And they used to say that at the spiritual bank that they would determine whether you could borrow money based on whether or not you were, you know, the dead told them to.
And they employ their own medium, a bank teller named Miss Carrick.
Exactly. Right. And you know, so given the fact that, A, she was a woman, and, B, she was a teller in the bank, so she had a job, I mean, that was already controversial. And in a way, that's what Seth loved. That's what attracted him to the spiritual movement, was that they allowed women in there. Because even the Congregational Church didn't allow women to vote on issues. They'd take their counsel, but they weren't allowed to vote. So there was a lot of, he was very progressive, let's say that.
Seth Payne had an unusual nickname at the time. The press called him the Queer Chicken. How did he get that nickname?
So the press got involved, basically, because not only through Seth's own inspiration, where he would call the press and tell them what was going on, but also because there were some very powerful bankers who were connected to the Chicago Democrat, which was owned by a guy from the who was involved in the legislature, who was John Wentworth. And so the Chicago Democrat started to really take a close eye on the spiritual bank and would just publish things that were just like the most outrageous possible. Does that sound familiar?
So you'd say he was a victim of the tabloid media.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, he was very radical. I mean, he, you know, he felt banks were not helping people. They were just there to steal their money, and he wanted to make that right. And so it was really kind of his idealism. But that being said, the banks really grabbed a hold of the newspapers, grabbed a hold of this. And, I mean, one reporter called him the Queer Chicken. And some of that was because Seth was a vocal vegetarian, which again was pretty progressive for that day. He didn't believe in the killing of any life, and so he created a lot of controversy with his bank, and the newspapers went crazy, and it was spread all over the country.
Let's talk about his business partner, Ira Eddy. From what I've read, Eddy really took a liking to Payne and agreed to front much of the capital for the bank when it got started. His family, however, had great concerns about Eddie's mental health and felt that he was under the influence of Payne and his cohort.
Correct. So Ira Eddy was his business partner and a backer of the bank, and he was from a Methodist, very powerful Methodist family. And his brother was a prominent minister in the region. They'd all kind of met each other through the Temperance Society, which was against liquor. And Seth was, of course, an advocate against liquor. And so initially it was kind of innocent, but Ira Eddy really loved the spiritualists. He really, he'd lost someone very dear to him, and he felt that he was communing with them through these spiritualists. And he felt that answered a lot of questions he'd had about heaven and hell and life and death. And so he started this. He owned this property, and he was leasing the bank and the business offices eventually to Seth Payne. And he had this place called Harmony Hall in the upstairs that was a big open hallway, and they would do spiritualist events there. And Seth was a very eloquent speaker, so he would come and speak there, and it just, you know, got out of control. But one of the things I will say is that, so his bills were, the Chicago Democrat, for all their critique of everything else about him, they said that his bills were some of the most beautiful pieces of currency that were published during that time. Now, the bills, he published $1, $2, and $3 bills, and they were supposed to be, they were notes, so that people would give you, you know, they'd give the bank $3, and the bank would give them a note that said they had $3 in the bank. And so the $1 bills had a portrait of Senator Douglas, Stephen Douglas, who was a very powerful advocate in those days for states' rights. On the $2 bill, Washington is crossing the Delaware in a portrait. And on the $3 bill, Henry Clay was drawn. And so the Chicago Democrat did say that they were the most beautifully executed bills in Chicago at that time, which I thought was kind of ironic.
So what then brings down the bank? The accounts I've read mention that when Eddie's family got involved, that shook confidence in it, and that there was then subsequently a run on the bank, followed by accusations of fraud and impropriety.
Yes. So definitely, Eddie's family, the Chicago Democrat, the newspaper in town, and other bankers who felt that they had normal banks. And so they called, there were shin plasters, and those were called a piece of currency with no value. So they were claiming that all of these banknotes were of no value. So they were shin plaster. And it was wildcat banking, which was banks that issued bills that were poorly capitalized. None of that was really true. He actually did back all of his money. But he was eventually indicted for 3 counts of signing promissory notes, for uttering bills of credit, and for signing bills. Now, he was, that's what he was indicted for. And he was very, very vocal about this. I mean, he thought at first that the press was his friend, and he found out later that they were not. But he went to jail for a couple weeks. He refused to post bail because when he got to jail, he saw the conditions of the jail and how these humans were being treated by people who had been his friends. And he thought it was just despicable. And so he would throw the money or throw the food back at the people who were delivering it and say, no human can eat this swill. And, wow. You know, was accused of almost inciting a riot in the jail itself. And Ira Eddie, on the other hand, was kind of grabbed by under cloak of darkness and taken to an insane asylum in the Eastern Coast. And backed by his family. Eventually, he was released because a bunch of people got on a train and went out there and fought in the court with the writ of habeas corpus to have him released, which he was. But I think he did spend a little time in an asylum just to kind of come back to reality, I guess. And so when they all came back, they went to court. First, they had to go to court to prove whether spiritualism itself was a creed. And it was proven that it was. And therefore, that the inciting of a riot with spiritualism was dismissed. And by that time, the bank had nothing left. I think he was fined $500 and then everything was dropped. However, his business was ruined. Seth Payne's business and Ira Eddy's business was completely in shambles.
Of course, the media salivated at the opportunity to cover the trial, which was probably salacious in itself without the media adding to it. There was a charge that the bookkeeper at the bank brandished a six-shooter and threatened to shoot a member of Eddie's family when he came to demand Eddie's money back. And then you had the testimony of the bank medium, Miss Herrick, who, according to the papers, put on quite a show during the trial, only to be told to be quiet by the judge, and then she spent some time after that apparently cursing out the court. So this must have been manna for Payne's enemies, who could point to this and say, see, we told you all along about this guy.
Exactly. I mean, there was an account that Seth at that time had long hair and a long beard and wore a white gown and would pick up his grandchild and hold it above the crowd and say, behold, you know, this is innocence. and this is what you know, we're fighting for, and he'd dance and get into trances, and you know, and he was accused of shoving somebody aside, and you know, he was a pacifist his entire life, so odds of that particular occurrence happening were slight, but some of the newspapers were kinder. Some of the newspapers said, you know, he was people who had been his friends, by the way, who owned newspapers in Wisconsin and in a couple other states, said, you know, he had a lot of power before this all happened. And as soon as he started to unravel, people just seized and jumped on that. And they really wanted to strip him of all that power because he had a voice of, you know, seemingly of reason in earlier times. And even though he was losing it then, they were threatened by that.
Obviously, as there's an elementary school named after him in Lake Zurich, there must be some echo of his influence still being felt in the area. How much of Payne's influence remains, in your opinion?
So part of my motivation for writing the book about him, and it's called The Anointed One, was that the more I dug into his history, the more I realized that he actually was very progressive for the time. And I'd like to think that that his story is worth telling. But the truth of the matter is that the other motivation for me was that there's a lot of mythology still about him. People said he was mocked in the streets for his belief. When you look up initial information about Seth Payne, all I found was that he was just odd, that he had this stable of humanity that people didn't really understand, that even his neighbors thought he was kind of funky, that he had this weird bank. You know, those were the stories that were told. But the more I dug, the more I realized he actually was just a progressive for his time. So, for instance, he was part of the Anti-Slavery Society and the abolitionist movement in a very strong way. He was part of the Underground Railroad, but he was quiet about it. He formed a League of Universal Brotherhood, which was based on the tenets of a man named Elihu Burritt, who it was a bunch of guys who got together to commit random acts of kindness in quiet. And eventually, at the end of his life, he built a woman's shelter in Chicago, and it had 140 women in it in 1870. And those women were put to work. You know, they were given jobs. They were given a foundation so that they could have a life. There was a lot of widows after the Civil War. He also fought in the Civil War or worked on the front lines with Alan Pinkerton in the Secret Service. And so, I mean, for all of his quirkiness, which again, you know, people tend to jump on, he actually was a pretty decent human being. And that's what he was his entire life. And that's what attracted me to him, to really dig deeper and tell his story.
So what happens to Payne after this whole banking ordeal is through? How did he choose to live out the rest of his days? And was he bitter?
So he went back to Lake Zurich, and he quietly started a newspaper there for a little while called the Christian Banker of Lake Zurich, or the Lake Zurich Banker. He started to have a little humor in it instead of just a newspaper where he talked about his enemies, which he had done earlier in one of his newspapers. And he had some tragedy. His dear mother, who he'd been close to his entire life and who had eventually moved out to the area, passed away. His first wife passed away. But he kept running the Stable of Humanity. He had a school in the Stable of Humanity that was free for the local students. I mean, this was pretty revolutionary. It was actually a real building with a real teacher that was hired from the local communities. He still housed people who were infirmed, and he, during the Civil War, his two sons signed up, and he signed up with his good friend Alan Pinkerton, and was part of the Secret Service and worked in Washington, D.C. to help emancipate the slaves prior to the first Emancipation Proclamation. So then he came back to Lake Zurich after the Civil War. He was treated to a presentation by Frederick Douglass in their community, and he continued to work as an abolitionist against slavery. And then eventually, his Stable of Humanity burned down, and he moved to Chicago, and that's where he formed the Woman's Home.
And in what year did he pass?
He passed in 1872, and he's buried at Graceland Cemetery, along with a lot of other very prominent Chicago people.
Well, Nancy, it's an incredible story, and you bring it to life exquisitely in your book. As numismatists and collectors, we are interested not only in the study of money and the collecting of objects, but also in the preservation of the stories that surround them. Books like yours shed real light into the life of Seth Payne, which will in turn enrich the serious collector of these spirit banknotes, of these Spirit Bank of Chicago banknotes. You're right, they're beautiful, and fortunately, they're still relatively inexpensive despite their scarcity. So, if you're looking to collect a very interesting series and learn about a fascinating and unique man, you have the opportunity. Nancy's book is titled The Anointed One: The Untold Story of Seth Payne, Midwest Abolitionist. It was published in June of this year and is available on Kindle and in paperback. And you can order it on Amazon or perhaps through your local bookseller if they allow special orders. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about them because the more I read about them, the more I liked them. The more I thought, yeah, people like this need to have a voice